Well, kia ora tato, everybody. I think we'll get underway bang on time. Firstly, for those that don't know me, I'm Joe Hollander, Chair of the Palmerston North Defence Heritage Advisory Group, and it's my pleasure again to be your MC for this evening. On this hour, I'll probably pinch this, the Mayor's speech notes, but on our 103rd anniversary of Armistice Day and 102nd anniversary of Remembrance Day, this is our last evening public lecture presentation for 2021. We've had some excellent presentations to date, and unfortunately, we've had to shift a few timings around, a few dates around to meet our various COVID restrictions. But I'm pleased to say that this year's program has been outstanding. And we've got an outstanding presentation tonight. Well, tonight it gives me great pleasure, firstly, to invite Wiramu Te Awi Awi to open with a mihi. And then I'm going to ask the Mayor to say a few words before I introduce the speaker. So without further ado, over to you.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
I was a bit worried about your treaty partners getting your act together. Anyway, Tato, let us bow our heads in prayer. E hone re glory ki te atua, e maungo ki te penu he whakaro pai ki ngā tangata katoa. Ha ki te atua ngā kauhau, i roto i tēnā mātou whakatungi te wāre tapu, he awhena tōjo he mātou, āke āke, amini. O tēnā koe he te rangatira katoa, i kui mai kuruma, ngā iwi ngā hau e whā, a tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Ngā mihi nui, ki a koutou. Nau mai, haere mai, i te whenua rangatāne o mēnua tū. Ngā mihi nui, ki a koutou. I roto i te paipere tapu, ko te whakapono te timanaku me te aroha, i me nui o te rangi Māori. Just a brief translation. First of all, I made honour to God. And I was quite interested when I read up the New Zealand peacemaking. The name Marae Rangiotu is Te Rangi Māori. And it's taken from the scriptures out of 1 Corinthians 13. Three things which remain: faith, hope, and love. But the grace of these is love. And for our marae at home, we are called what is takawaina, and it's trying to keep our people together. And since we've had treaty claims, and Grant and I had to guide our lot through rough times, but we're working together. And at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. Unfortunately, I'd love to stay all night. I've got Zoom calls coming in. You know, you got the Mayor there, and there's the Mayor me, you know, from Rangiotu, and I never been so busy. Sometimes I have to fill in for the Mayor because he can't make it. See, that's treaty partnership. Nō reira, tēnā koutou katoa. Kia ora. Yo e, ka mate aho, e hine hoki mai rā. Yo e, he ka mate aho, e hine hoki mai rā. Nō reira, tēnā koutou katoa. And if I don't see you, because I have to slip out, have a wonderful Christmas. And remember, Jesus is the reason for the season. Joe loves that.
Gotcha. Kia ora.
Gotcha.
Good man. Kia ora tato, everybody. And no, I'm not going to sing. Wiramu's great at that. And just want to acknowledge Rangatane and Wiramu. Thank you for opening up, also Joe, and your Heritage Advisory Group for being so passionate about having these sorts of events. I think it's really important that we do that. To Peter, thank you for being our speaker tonight, and obviously everybody else that's attending. Look, it's great to be here again and have our regular Armistice Day military lecture. And over the years, there's been some really, really interesting topics and speakers, as Joe's alluded to earlier, and tonight's no exception. with Lieutenant Colonel Peter Wood. He's the director of the New Zealand Wars Study Centre at New Zealand Defence College. And the subject, obviously, behind me here is New Zealand's role in peacekeeping since World War II in 1945. A few little connections there for me personally. Peter and I owned the same house. He bought my house off me when he came here to Linton Camp. And my cousin was a captain that went to Bosnia in one of the peacekeeping deployments. So, you know, we've got some connections there. But today is obviously special in being Armistice Day, and I just want to acknowledge those that attended our City 11 a.m. service and then the Poppy Places naming event afterwards. And I think the City can rightly be proud of our contribution, but also honouring those that gave the ultimate sacrifice. And look, tonight also, I just want to acknowledge some people that have made tonight happen. It takes a bit of resources to get these things going, and as Joe said, it's not easy in COVID times. So obviously want to thank the Speaker, but also the Palmerston North Heritage, sort of Defence Heritage Group, the Globe Theatre, who've done a great job in keeping these sorts of things going, and obviously Leslie and the City Library team, and everybody else that's coming out to support these things. So, like Wirriman, I've got to talk to a scout group at 7 o'clock, so Peter, I'm going to hear as much as I can, and then I may have to duck out the door too. But thank you again, everybody, for coming along. It's really important that we continue these lectures. Thank you.
Thank you, Rurumu, and thank you, Grant. It's great to have your support in keeping this program alive. Peter and I have been associated over many years. And I have to say, now that he's actually with the Defence College, he's come on board as a member of the Defence Heritage Advisory Group and is giving us some excellent advice on directions that we should be taking to preserve the city's military history and heritage. So really, without further ado, I'll ask Peter to come and deliver his presentation on New Zealand's involvement in peacekeeping since 1945. Thanks, Peter.
Now, tēnā koutou katoa. Welcome, everybody. It's great to be here on Armistice Day evening to be part of the activities of the day. And for all of those of you who are involved today, well done for doing that. Now, thanks also for the introductions, gents, and you too, Joe. Joe's given me a big topic, and I don't propose to go through absolutely every mission at all or in detail. What I'll tend to do is background for about 10 minutes, how missions come about, how the UN deploys them, the numbers of people today involved in peacekeeping around the world, and then we'll go through a series of missions that the New Zealanders were involved in. The early ones where we were looking at borders, and they're all still running today, so 60 years plus we started there. Then the middle ground, some missions where we were involved in conflicts where there had been civil wars. And finally, we'll look at a couple of the contemporary and more complex missions that are running today. New Zealand's been connected with the United Nations since its inception, with its first peacekeeping as UNMOS to UNMO GIP, which was the India-Pakistan in 1952. So that was our first deployment. And we've been involved in peacekeeping operations ever since. The former Secretary-General of the day that you can see there, Doug Hammarskjöld, he said that peacekeeping is no job for soldiers, but only soldiers can do it. And he was correct in the day, but really today what we find is that it's not just soldiers, but it's the men and women of the Army, Navy, Air Force, and indeed the Police Force and other New Zealanders who are increasingly involved in modern day operations. I'd put a little bit of a spin on this thing to say that members of the Defence Force, who they can do peacekeeping, but if we just trained up people to do peacekeeping, I don't think it would go the other way where they could undertake modern military operations. So there's that distinction there. This map illustrates, and you don't have to read the whole thing, that just illustrates that the sheer number of peace operations that are going on the globe today. And the big circles clump up the United Nations, European Union, NATO, African Union and the OSCE that are running all kinds of missions today. So it's quite complicated. And the red rectangles there, they're just the ones going in Iraq. And so what I'm trying to say there is that, you know, now there's layers of different organisations all trying to contribute to resolving these quite complex missions. You can see the coloured bits there, the countries that are involved. But there's basically 150,000 people overseas around the world at the moment doing peacekeeping operations. The UN makes up the bulk of them, of course, but other organisations fairly large contributions. Okay, and you can spot the Kiwi in the group. He's an Unmo Gip, that first deployment. But up at that stage in 1954, you wore your national headdress. But since then, the blue beret or blue caps come into vogue, and that's been it. You still wear your national uniform. So the scope, really, I'll have a look at the background to peacekeeping. We'll talk about those original missions that are still running today, albeit Unmo Gip. This one here doesn't have any New Zealanders now. We'll talk about a couple of complex and complicated missions, and then we'll finish off looking at Iraq. CTF 150 had a victory last night in the Arabian Gulf. We can talk about that. And I just want to acknowledge the police contribution to peacekeeping as well. When I first saw this chart, it kind of staggered me a bit. These are the current 16 operations, and that's the numbers of years that they've been running. So, UNSO in the Middle East, coming up to 70 years. And, you know, Unmo Gip not far behind it. The Cyprus mission, again, you know, in excess of 50 years. These are long running missions, which, you know, once they get started, you never really know when they're going to end, and once you commit to them, you never really know if your commitment's going to end or how it's going to vary along the way. This table here looks at New Zealand involvement in peace operations. So the blue spikes, that's when we had major troop concentrations, and the green are like staff officers and UNMOs. And the ready colour is police. But, you know, we've had large numbers going, particularly to Cambodia, Bosnia and Timor. That accounts for the peaks. And then you've got to ask yourself, you know, we know a lot of people are away. Well, where are they if they're not with the UN? But the truth is, pretty much in the last few years or so, large numbers have been deployed, but they've usually been deployed in non-United Nations missions. So Iraq would be one, Afghanistan would be another, those sort of ones. So they're going in with other organisations to contribute to peace efforts there. So just looking at that chart there, and it's the second to last one really, the numbers, you'd think we'd know how many people are deployed on operations, like, you know, but in fact we don't really. So this is data from the Medals Office. And it shows only those that have deployed since 1975, so pretty much after Vietnam. That's in reverse order by location. I don't know how that happened. It doesn't make it so easy to read. But a few things. Timor, or Timor-Leste as it became after elections, that's clearly our largest deployment. Nearly 6,000 people deployed there. And we still have a few people there as advisors. Afghanistan sticks out with big numbers from 2001 with the Provincial Reconstruction Team, or PRT, Special Forces and all sorts of other groups that were deployed. But once the Reconstruction Team and others went down, our contribution was much more modest. The Sinai has had big numbers. It's been a long-standing mission. And while we have always had a training team there, some engineers and a transport section, there was, for a number of years, an RNZAF helicopter detachment that flew in support of the mission there. Syria, at the other end of the scale, hardly even makes it right at the top there onto the mark. It's possibly the Defence Forces and the United Nations' shortest ever mission. They went off there to Syria to try and mediate, and you know, 10 years, and they bounced almost straight out of it. And 10 years later, we're still living with the problems in that particular country. So they went there in 2012, you know, almost 10 years ago, and they weren't there for very long. We've still got the problems. The Solomons has had about 1,650 military, nearly 500 police, and that, along with Bougainville, again, sizable numbers, recognises New Zealand's commitment within our near region. Next in scale would be Iraq, where the New Zealand Defence Force is still represented today, but since the withdrawal of the Taji-based training team, where they worked in conjunction with the Australian Defence Force, sort of an ANZAC thing there going on, and when it withdrew last year, our numbers there today are quite modest, single digits. I'd also draw your attention to the three Indian Ocean-type missions there. New Zealand participation principally by Navy, but also with P3 Orion supports those missions. In all, the NZDF estimates that about 21,000 New Zealand personnel or Defence Force personnel have deployed on peace operations since 1975. And they based an assumption on about 15 of those going to the same mission twice or maybe doing several missions, they reckon about 18 to 19,000 New Zealanders have deployed just since 1975. And this is the last set of numbers. It really just sort of asks, the one on the left, it's just a very recent photograph. The Defence Force, in conjunction with the Australians, sent a flyaway team up to the Middle East, conducted COVID-19 testing on the MFO deployment. So you can see there's Italian peacekeepers on the mission. They're going through the New Zealanders being tested there for COVID. So you can see there's been a couple of spikes in casualties there since the inception of peacekeeping. You can see, though, despite all of that, that illness and accident are the greatest casualty causes, because malicious acts, gunshot, rockets and all that sort of stuff, that's probably that's the last of those categories. And you can see, though, that the military components have the largest casualty count, way more than internationals, police, even the little observers that we talked about, the Blue Berets, they have much less casualty. So that is the last. So no more graphs. So I just want to talk a little bit about how missions come about and use the United Nations as an example of that before we look at how New Zealand becomes involved. The decision-making body for the United Nations is the United Nations Security Council. Any proposed missions must have a majority vote and not be vetoed by one of the principal five permanent members that are listed up there, I think, yes. The UN's Department of Peace Operations is charged with putting the mission together, getting contributions of troops or police and from all the different countries to try and make up the type of force that they've assessed is required to undertake the mission that they've got. And much of that will be based on the mandate that they get. Will it be Chapter 6 or Chapter 7? Chapter 6 is more usual, where you're basically trying to keep the peace. Probably Chapter 7 is where you are trying to enforce or make peace, and you have to go on a much harder and heavier type of mission there. If there's no UN mandate for a mission, technically it's illegal, but when the UK, France and the United States couldn't get Russia or China to agree to Kosovo, we know they went in anyway, and then when the US and the UK couldn't get UN support for Iraq, in 2003, we know that went as well. So, you know, the UN is there, but it's not always, its rules aren't always adhered to by all the members. So, New Zealand just doesn't leap at every invitation that it gets. It sort of filters through them, and these are the sort of questions that the government and the Defence Force and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade that they look at. What would be the implications of us deploying? Is it legal? Are there any other options? So they'll have a think about all of that. And that's taken from the MFAT website, and they have a big part to play in deciding who goes and if we go at all. So there's three basic questions. The first one, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade the Ministry of Defence and the Defence Force each look at this separately and together. You know, should we go? Is it worth us going to this thing? What are the optics? Can we? Should we? Then if the answer is yes or probably yes, then they'll have a look at could we? Do we have the forces available for the type of conflict that's envisaged? Can we keep rotating them for a year, 2 years, 3 years? What are the risks? All those sort of things. So they have a look at the doability. And then finally, the Prime Minister and Cabinet, they're the ones that answer the question about will we? And it's them that sign off. And you'll see on the left there, that is a copy of the decision that Cabinet made to extend the Iraq deployment. So deployments are approved and then Defence can get underway to mount them, but they're subject to usually annual reviews and changes perhaps to the force structure that goes along. So, that's how missions come about. And not everything that's asked for by the UN or other organisations gets agreed to. And in fact, when I handed in the presentation a week ago, this thing arrived in my inbox. So they've just agreed a P3 to go up and join the UNMOS that we have up in Korea. They won't work for New Zealanders, they'll work for the mission to do the task of looking for breaches of the UN sanctions by the North Koreans up there. Before departure, some form of pre-deployment training is always undertaken, and it varies between Army, Navy and Air Force in its extent and its type. This is an Army pre-deployment training. Some of you will recognise the terrain there. Interestingly though, the woman on the left firing a pistol, she's from the Air Force, and she was required to do that because she was joining a land operation. So before she could go to Iraq, she had to qualify like all the rest of us on everything. So what does an Army pre-deployment training look like? Week one, treat them. Intelligence briefings, operations briefings, psychological briefings, close call to combat for sort of self-defence, and there's welfare type briefs, and there's opportunity for families to come and join their deploying partners to hear about what happens on the mission, and people talk to you who've been there before so you get an idea of what's coming at you. Week two is undertaken at Linton, so it's in our area now, and they come here to the School of Military Engineering. They learn about IEDs and explosives, what to do if you get tangled up in them. The health organisation teaches you about not just first aid, but trauma management, and they stick you on your own in somewhere and you've got to deal with a casualty that's bleeding all over the place, so it's really realistic, and there's all sorts of how to deal with interpreters, all the practical stuff. And then on week three, which is happening here, you get to shoot pistol and or rifle, both, sometimes one to the other, and you and or your target are moving or doing whatever you're doing. It's quite a lot of fun. But, you know, it's designed, it's the short range sort of stuff, and you can see how close those targets are there to the firers. So you'll do some sort of preparation before you get stuck out the door there. Right, so what I want to do now is go through the sort of the missions, starting with those early ones. So this one is UNMO GIP. In 1947, India and Pakistan became independent. One of the things was that Kashmir was free to go with either India or Pakistan. Their accession to India, though, was a matter of dispute between India and Pakistan, mainly the Pakistanis, and fighting broke out. So in April, the UN approved an increase in the membership there, and we deployed three observers in 1952. And that won't be one of the originals. Well, I don't know if they went for a year or 6 months, but that's at least the second, third or fourth rotation, that individual there. They worked in small teams on both sides of the ceasefire line, where their main tasks were to monitor compliance with the ceasefire agreement and investigate breaches. And even today, that's the kind of work that UNMOS still do, and they would be, as you can see there, unarmed. Today, UNMO GIP still has 43 UNMOS in it from different countries and 72 civilian staff. New Zealand ended its commitment, though, in 1971 as typically a cost-saving measure. Anyway, I was attracted to the image on the right by the fact that these are Korean UNMOS and there's New Zealanders in Korea doing the exact same job between the north and the south. Yeah. And, of course, they've got helmets now because I think the risks have gone up a little bit. This next one is an early one we were involved in, is called UNSO. In May 48, when the UK relinquished its mandate over Palestine and the State of Israel was proclaimed, Palestinians and Arab states took up arms against Israel. In 1948, the UN called for a cessation of hostilities in Palestine and then decided that the truce should be supervised by a UN mediator, supported by a group of observers, military observers. Excuse me. And this group of military observers was known as the United Nations Treaty Supervision Organisation, or UNTSO, established in 1949. New Zealand sent officers to the mission from May 1954 and maintains its commitment to the present day. Teams of unarmed UNTSO military observers are attached, though, to the two UN armed forces in the mission, the UNDOF, the Disengagement Observer Force, and the interim force in Lebanon known as UNIFIL, but the UNMOs themselves are unarmed. The slide shows the contributing countries and the number of people involved, so it's a big mission. And the top picture is Major General Dave Gawn signing over when he relinquished command and handed over, I think, to an Australian officer. So from time to time, New Zealanders have commanded that mission. And then just take a bit of a look into the mission itself. So typically the UNMOs, they will work, the triangles up in the Golan and up in Lebanon there, that's the observation posts, and they will be looking across to see if anything on both sides of the borders is moving, any troop concentrations. They'll do inspections and they'll do patrols in that area there. And there's three of the New Zealand UNMOs in a recent deployment. The final border operation I'll have a look on, this is a 2021 photograph, is called UNCMAC, the UN Command Military Assistance Commission. It was established in 1950. Then in 1953, an armistice agreement was signed which ended the Korean War. This resulted in a 241-kilometre long and 4-kilometre wide buffer zone called the Demilitarized Zone, or the DMZ, and it was created and still separates the North Korean and South Korean armed forces. New Zealanders have served in UNCMAC since 1998, so we weren't early joiners of it. They do a six-month tour of duty. They monitor the demilitarised zone, again, to ensure that the parties, and you notice the woman there is unarmed, to ensure that the parties adhere to the agreement. So in addition to our UNMOs there at the present, of course, there's that P3 Orion that just has gone up for the month here that I mentioned earlier. So far then, we've covered three UNMO-type missions. They're all unarmed, they work in multinational groups, they are observing and reporting back, but they're not really positioned to actually take much action. So what now I'll do is just go into some of the missions that have been where there's been a civil war as opposed to a dispute between neighbouring countries. So this is Angola. Some would say, why were we there? And others would say, where's Angola? Southwest Africa there. This started when two nationalist groups, the MPLA and UNITA, took up arms against the Portuguese in 1960. Then in 1975, there was a change of government in Portugal. They basically left Mozambique, Angola and East Timor overnight. And of course, the MPLA and UNITA fell in on each other and there was a civil war. The MPLA were largely supported by Cuba and Russia, the communists, and UNITA were largely supported by the West, so they were the democratic side, if you like. So it was like the Cold War being played out by proxies. In late 88, the UN established the United Nations Angola Verification Mission, UNAVIM, and this was designed to oversee the Cuban forces that were in the country supporting the MPLA. New Zealand sent 15 UNMOs to UNAVIM 2. They were deployed throughout the country, so that usual, you know, none of the New Zealanders, no one's together, you're all spread about, to investigate violations. Following an election, which the UN facilitated, in which the UNITA lost, they went back to war, and all the New Zealanders and all the UNAVIM people came out of the country in a rush. Although in February 1995, the UN Security Council approved the establishment of a third mission, the 7,500-strong UNAVIM 3, we sent 5 UNMOs and several demining instructors, and the latter group was to help set up a demining school because Angola is littered with about 12 million landmines, they estimate. UDVM 3 was succeeded by Monua, the fourth iteration, and its mandate was to assist in the demobilisation of UNITA forces as well as the disarmament of the local population. And this is the one that I was involved in, which I'll talk about. So typically the UN will divide up a country, so there's six regions there, and their headquarters is in the capital of Luanda, where the demining school happens to be. So as an example, the southeast region, there were six team sites, so we'll talk a little bit about Likura in a second, where I was. Then Monongi is the regional headquarters, and that's typical UN. A number of team sites report to a regional headquarters, where you've got a bigger headquarters, a helicopter and all that sort of thing, and then they all report back in turn to the force headquarters. So there's your basic team site. Up on the top right, the little white specks and the red circle that I've drawn on there, that's the team site in the African bush, about 800 metres off the end of an airfield. Down the bottom, that's the team site. It's basically on sand in the bush. A little bit of scrappy barbed wire there for protection. Your typical white UN sort of tents. A couple of UN white Land Cruiser type vehicles. That's basic stuff there. You might have a stove, a refrigerator. There'd be three generators to power it all. Sometimes only two would be working and sometimes one. And then you would amend how you were going after there. And the picture up on the left there is our locally employed guy. We used him as a chef, and he's killing a goat that we bought for our rations. So we had either goat and rice or rice and goat. There wasn't much variation, but that's just, as an unknown, you're out there sort of basically doing your job. So there were plenty of signs of the war. So these bridges have been taken down by aircraft bombs and stuff. Yeah, the armoured vehicle on the right-hand side has been blown off by an anti-tank mine, and those jets, not only the fact that they're downed is because someone's got anti-aircraft missiles. In fact, both sides got anti-aircraft missiles, and by the way, you wouldn't dare approach them or the bridge because of landmines, so you need a zoom on your camera to get that sort of close. The landmines are everywhere. You would not step off the road or the tarmac. So typical tasks, what we'd be doing. So on the top left, the UN has got one of two contracted C-130 aircraft, and each region has one of those MI-8 Russian helicopters, and they would take troops and stuff around, but they were required to take the demobilised guerrillas and their family back to their home locations from our airstrip. And the helicopter would take us out to towns where we would oversee the transfer of control of the town from the UNITA guerrillas back to the government, and then they would take those weapons that had been handed in back to the regional headquarters and thence back to the capital for destruction. So they were the kind of jobs we were doing. We step back a level now to the regional headquarters, see a much larger type camp, more tents, better communications equipment, and we're actually on the outskirts of a town there in Monongi. This photo is there, just shows you this is the regional headquarters sort of staff. You can see the countries along the way there that are there. You've got to deal, you know, with you having to work with a whole lot of different people, so you divide them up. Someone's the operations officer, the logistics officer, the personnel officer, so you give them sort of jobs, you have to work with them. The guy from Bangladesh and the fellow from India, they had perfect English, the rest of us kind of were okay. But that guy from Guinea-Bissau, he couldn't speak English. So you're dealing with all kinds of language and issues of professional knowledge and skill and experience and all that sort of thing. It's a very interesting and sometimes trying thing. But again, everyone's split up. There's no groups of New Zealanders or Indians in there. We're all sort of split up. And it's good and interesting, but it can be very, very trying. Before we leave that particular start to close off on that mission, I just mentioned the fact that the New Zealanders were involved in the setting up of a demining school. The aim there was to teach Angolans basically how to search for and destroy mines. And New Zealand instructors, mainly engineers, went over and did that. But as the mission evolved, The New Zealanders, instead of being instructors, they were now the mentors for the Angolans. And the end state was that the Angolans ran the school and did the instruction, and then the New Zealanders and the other countries were able to withdraw. And many, well, some New Zealanders who leave the army actually go on back to demining NGOs and other things to carry on with that dangerous and specialist skill there. The mission didn't end well. The C-130 that you saw earlier, it and its mate that you didn't see were both shot down by UNITA using missiles, and UNITA went back to war largely because its leader Jonas Savimbi was very headstrong. However, he was killed fighting the government troops. Very soon after, you know, the resistance collapsed, and then UNITA came in and was basically an opposition party, so it became a political arm in Angola. Though the country is still in a huge humanitarian crisis, mainly because of the prolonged war and the abundance of minefields. So another large involvement that New Zealand had overseas, again another Portuguese colony that disintegrated. So after Portugal's withdrawal from Timor, Indonesia intervened militarily and declared Timor to be its 27th province. The UN never recognised this and called for Indonesia to withdraw. UNIMED, an unarmed mission, was established to oversee a popular consultation about whether the Timorese would accept having some sort of autonomy inside Indonesia or not. And 78% of people rejected the autonomy, wanting independence from Indonesia. When the result was announced, pro-integration militias, at times supported by the Indonesian military, launched a widespread campaign of violence, looting and arson. Many Timorese were killed and 500,000 people were displaced. Many of those who sought sanctuary across the border did so in Indonesia. Then the UN went back to Indonesia, got agreement from the went back to Dili, got an agreement from the Indonesians, and a force called Interfet, so outside of the UN, led by Australia, was designed to go up in there. And they did. In September 1999, they set up a border management system, they established refugee return plan, and they facilitated humanitarian assistance operations. And there was a lot of media over this at the time, like some of you will recall, but many members of the New Zealand Defence Force, Army, Navy and Air Force and Police were all part of Interfet. While Interfet was in country, they rebadged to Untayet, and all six battalion rotations went. About May and November each year, the battalion groups would change over. Each of those is about 600 New Zealanders, each battalion group, so you know, 3,500 just infantry going over there, and numerous helicopter detachments also took place over the three-year period. Now, this shows NZBAT 4, so the fourth rotation. It's about to deploy. These are largely Linton-based personnel. Of the 600, 200 are going back for their second deployment, and they're being farewelled at Timorai Ohine shortly before their deployment. And that Timorai Ohine is the courtyard of the Door for a Peace, so quite an appropriate point from which to send off your peacekeepers on their mission. Just a couple of images to show the kind of activities. So essentially a lot of patrols are undertaken. The blue patrols and the blue beret, high profile out there, designed to show and give confidence that we were around and providing security and protection for people. But the green patrols, these ones there are a bit more covert. You're checking on militia insertion routes and things like that to make sure that nothing's happening that you're not aware of, and so they're a lot more covert. The Air Force is there with its white-painted Iroquois aircraft, not just supporting the New Zealand battalion, but also supporting the rest of the force all the way through Timor, very high profile. The New Zealand Police was there on the right. Inspector Baz Bailey was the police regional commander, worked with him a lot over the elections, and they're manning a command post during the election that took place while we're there to make sure that there were no problems. And down the bottom is two images of police. and soldiers, and what they're doing is they are checking the personal effects and baggage and stuff that refugees are bringing back from Indonesia before they get taken and they go back to the villages that they were displaced from. So they're sort of typical tasks, typical living conditions. See, these young soldiers are up in a platoon forward operating base on a hill we call Gate Par. Pretty rudimentary. They've tried to pour a little bit of concrete, having to scrub their own pots. And you can see a little strong point up there that they've got so that they can observe the area. That was their patrol base. And then down on the low ground, there's an example. The biggest base we had was our own forward operating base at Suwai with the battalion headquarters, logistics elements under headquarters. So that was the kind of facilities that we were in. All built by or developed by New Zealand. This slide here just sort of shows that the Air Force, the New Zealand Air Force, was an integral part of the mission, ever reliable. They transported troops in challenging flying conditions, mountains, jungle landing zones, sides of hills, hot, all that sort of routine. And this picture illustrates some of the tasks. So on the left, supporting ground troops with patrol insertion, resupply, casualty evacuation. And down on the bottom right, there's some members of 3 Squadron, plus some Australian colleagues from the Australian Army Helicopter Squadron, and they're just painting a school. So there's lots of hearts and minds work that they do as part of their job there. So how does the process kind of roll? When you finish your time, there's the challenge for the incoming commanding officer and members of the battalion. The full noise for the haka, the whole thing there. Then in groups of about 200, you get on big Russian helicopters, the Russians are always providing helicopters, and you fly up to the northern coast of Timor, where you have to unpack every item of your clothing and gear, disassemble the whole lot and clean it and pick out every little grass seed, because members of not only customs but agriculture and all that sort of thing, they're up there to check out our gear. It all gets packed up, sealed up and returned home. So, 3,000 New Zealanders aren't bringing back wild animals and seeds and all that sort of routine. And finally, the Mayor of the day welcomed the Regimental Sergeant Major, so quite good to have a reception group when you land back in New Zealand. And then after that is the families. And this was the welcome home parade that was done shortly after the final rotation. And I really put there just to demonstrate, because all people on that parade there had deployed. So that's Navy, you can see some of the Air Force up the back, and the Greens or the Army. That is the sheer number of people there. And I mean, it was a very good gesture by the government and by the New Zealand to have such a parade, and that doesn't always happen to contingents. So it was much appreciated. So just now, move from there up into the modern day. This is a more complex type operation now. It's not a UN mission. There's 72 countries. This is Operation Inherent Resolve. It's ongoing in Iraq. And so we'll just have a little look at that. Early in 2015, the key cabinet announced that the Defence Force would contribute and build partner capacity element in conjunction with the Australian Defence Force. Essentially, our role would be to train Iraqi soldiers to be soldiers so they would fight the Islamic State. And you can see the extent that Islamic State was in 2015, and basically it's been pinned back since about 2019, but the training was still going on. So Cabinet approved a 2-year commitment in 4 6-month rotations. Well, there ended up being 10 rotations, so 5 years. So the training team, and you can see the training sites and the different countries that were involved. Our training team with the Australians focused on building partner capacity, training Iraqi security force units to fight the Islamic State. It was somewhat like a sausage factory, with an endless succession of Iraqi troops passing through and being trained. Although, a bit like the demining school, the Australian and New Zealand contribution changed over time, so instead of training soldiers, we were now training trainers, and then training their bosses how to run those schools effectively and efficiently. And you can see that there. They left the mission when it was completed last year at about March, April. But We still have a few people based in Iraq, so that the training staff based in Baghdad, so their forward operating base, quite different to Suwai with the barbed wire. These blast walls are to stop rockets and IEDs from going off just outside the camp, and that vehicle there is pointing at the Iraqi guarded gate there to make sure that anybody comes through who's going to get held up there. This shows the sheer scale of the headquarters. And one thing that I found interesting was that, you know, this is a land-based operation, but there were many people from the Navy and the Air Force of all the countries, you know, with the RAF and Royal Navy and, you know, just all the different forces there. A lot of women involved. It wasn't just men, a lot of women involved. A few police, a lot of contractors, and a lot of civilians as well. Quite a big thing there. And the warrant officer up the top there is dining in the dining facility, quite different to those soldiers who are up at Gate Par having to clean up their own pots. This is all done by contracted staff there for you. You know, we try and mark significant occasions while we're away. Those RSA parcels arrive at Christmas time. They're always well appreciated. Anzac, Armistice Day today will be celebrated up in Iraq. You've got Germans in the mission, French in the mission, Americans in the mission, Brits, Kiwis. So, you know, they'll make quite a big deal of it, like they did there this year on Anzac Day. When you're deployed, you've always got to expect the unexpected. UNMOs that went to UNSO in the Middle East got redeployed to Srebrenica in former Yugoslavia because they were already deployed, they got them over there. Another group, I was just talking to Joe about this earlier, thought they were going to UNPROFOR in Yugoslavia for 6 months, but they got home under Helen Clark in time for Christmas, so they were back, they'd only done a 3-month tour. Our little surprise moment was there was some trouble with Baghdad, and large numbers of us, you can see, were about to board blacked out Chinook helicopters. We're flown out of the area and then taken across, and we're shoveled into the back, and we're sitting on the floor, not on the seats, and we just rammed into these C-17s and flying out there back out to Kuwait. So we never expected that kind of thing. You've just got to, I think, all peacekeepers, all people deployed, you know, you're trained for certain stuff, but, you know, different things happen along the way, and you just got to roll with it. I just want to start to wind down a bit by talking about a current operation involving mainly the Navy. They don't get a lot of recognition for this. A lot of people associate Army in particular, but then perhaps the Air Force. But the Navy makes a significant contribution. So this is CTF 150, Combined Task Force 150, a 16-nation multinational task group composed of warships from numerous from those nations, and we've contributed this since 2010 with either Anzac frigates, surveillance aircraft P3, staff officers, and at the moment a New Zealand officer is commanding Task Force 150. It operates in an area of 8.3 million square kilometres, the Gulfs of Aden and Oman, the Arabian and Red Seas, and the Northern Indian Ocean, and it disrupts criminal and terrorist organisations and their related illicit activities. And you see on screen a boarding party is going off to Adal to do an intercept there, and that was the captain of the day back in 2015. And just came in this morning was a report that this Kiwi-led operation yesterday, major drug haul, and those drugs would have been used to support terrorism, and so it's a big win. So they low profile, if you like, but actually having quite a big impact. This is the size of their area of operations against the thing there, so quite a large side. And so, just before I close off, I'd just like to acknowledge the role, often unnoticed, that our own police make. If you can work with them on a peacekeeping operation, it's really good. But often they are grouped separately, but they have made quite a contribution, at least as far back as the 60s, and you know, up until the present day. And you know, there the Ramsey Group is meeting the Governor General of the day up in the Solomons. So I think I'll leave it there because we'll have a bit of time for questions, I hope. But you know, it's not just been the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, our police, other New Zealanders, ambassadors sometimes get involved in these. And you know, we're interested in this rules-based order, so we have to make modest and sometimes larger contributions from time to time. I hope I've been able to demonstrate that we've gone from, and still do, monitor borders and lines with UNMOS, but they are now more complex. We're dealing not only with the results of civil war, but also complex operations where it's not just Syria and Iraq, but you've got Iran on the side, you've got ISIS on the inside. Even the Iraqi factions are split up, and it's a multifaceted operation. You're not just separating them, you might be trying to run elections, build schools, you know, all sorts of things. It's very complicated. And there has been, though, a subtle shift by New Zealand away from UN missions. We're still supporting those low-level UNMO ones, but a lot of large contingents now are operating outside of the UN, although missions that would be endorsed by the UN. And, of course, to bring it back to the Manawatū, many of those deployed were based out of Linton or Pohākehā, and most of them, even if they weren't, would have rotated or trained at Linton at some stage prior to being deployed. So quite a significant commitment and support we've had from the region. So with that, I just went backwards there. I'll just, whatever time we've got available, Joe, happy to take questions.
Excellent. Thanks, Peter.
Right. Questions. A lot to cover in a very short space of time. But questions that I'm sure Peter will be able to answer. Yeah.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for a fascinating talk. Some of those peacekeeping operations have been going on for a very long time. Is there any end in sight? And is that a military question, or is it something for somebody else?
Well, mostly they're political. There's a political resolution. So, as an example, you know, just the death of Savimbi was enough to. The UNITA basically collapsed. And outside of all of this, you know, you recall the ANC in South Africa has come into the political, the IRA is now involved in politics, not all the time, but so sometimes there's a political thing there. So if you look at it now, I don't see India and Pakistan resolving anything. Korea, we know, is trouble. And unless there is a kind of a Palestine-Israel arrangement that's acceptable to them and to the other Arab states, I don't know. So I don't blame the peacekeepers. I don't think it's a failure on the part of the peacekeepers. I think it's more a failure in that respect of the world and the groups involved to come to an acceptable political result. That's what that is. Yeah. I mean, I think if there's a border issue and it gets resolved, you know, it'll fade away, but they're really difficult ones, and so they're all going.
Yeah. Other questions?
Try and use this one.
I was just wondering if you knew that, well, whether the government of New Zealand has a framework by which it judges the merits of an ongoing tour, and is that widely spread across governments, or is it there's some criteria that people use to judge the likelihood of them carrying on?
Yeah, the document that I showed is probably the end result of a lot of that analysis. So, and it's not just by the Defence Force. I think the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade looks at a lot of the optics of what's going on, and the Ministry of Defence is actually separated from the Defence Force, so it can provide an alternative view to defence force so that you get a challenge. And there definitely are criteria that they set around the risk, how long it can go for. In fact, many people didn't think we could last the number of years we did last in Timor. I think when Timor went, they were looking at 18 months, so the 1st Battalion was going to do 9 and the 2nd group was going to do 9, and then it quickly became 4 lots of 6. So you're always doing an assessment of that. So there are criteria, and there is a lot of information that NFAT provides, in particular for the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet and the PM to look at, so that Cabinet can weigh up whether or not to keep the mission going or not. And they also keep a fairly tight rein on the numbers, so they might authorise X and you get a small margin of increase during a rotation, but the Defence Force can't just sneak in other capabilities, and you can't be involved in this area and then just sort of creep your way across to do another task that you might find more interesting. So they have a lot of ways, and one of the ways they do that is that we report back on a quite a regular basis what we're doing and all the rest of it, and then that gets seen simultaneously by NFAT, by DPMC, MOD and Defence Force. So there's a lot of openness around who's where, and that all helps to form a picture there. And there are other agencies that assess the risk and provide advice to the government as well to ultimately make the decision.
Any other questions? Steve. This one's probably a plant, is it?
No, it's not.
No, no, you're good.
The two parts of it really is, are there any of the deployments, and I think this is a personal comment, that we should have been there, and others that are that have been there, we should have been?
Well,
there's no pressure, is
it? Angola is an example of a mission where we probably wouldn't have gone to Africa, but we were members of the Security Council, and I think as a result of that, we ended up contributing to it. And then there's the occasion where, it was outside of peacekeeping, but we didn't go to Iraq, and then when we did, it was only a bridging element. I think engineers went to do bridging. I don't, as to missions that we should have been in and didn't go, I might get in trouble answering that, but none of them actually really come to mind. It's more about, I think, for and you see this with soldiers or people that have been on a mission when they know it's ending, which is fine, but actually the people that they've associated with, they realise, and Angola's a classic, and to a degree Timor's the same. The conditions on the ground for the average member of those countries hasn't actually improved a lot. Maybe the war's ended, but maybe a famine started or more and more poverty. So that's probably more the disappointing part, and that's where maybe if the troops aren't there, then whatever funds we do have for aid, NZ aid or whatever, we start contributing to improve the lot there. Yep, some deployments are controversial, and others become controversial because of certain things that happen in there, but that happens. Every mission we've been on, has been government directed and sanctioned, so they've decided that it's all good to go. Yeah.
Any others? All right. Well, look, I really like to thank Peter again and show our appreciation. It covers a very wide spectrum of operations, and I think a lot of people within the Palmerston North community hear about or read in the paper about some of these activities, but they don't really understand the complexity. And I mean, just that brief presentation covering all of that activity over that period of time and the number of New Zealand Defence Force personnel involved is quite incredible when you think about it. I mean, there are other dimensions. There are technical deployments or technical advisory type activities. I was privileged to spend 3 months in the Soviet Union advising on technical matters as a serving member of the armed forces. That was really weird because they were our enemy. And, you know, in some of those earlier days, you know, the government would dream up all sorts of weird, wonderful things for us to get involved in. So I just hope this evening's been useful for you in understanding another dimension of the New Zealand Defence Force. And please tell your families, tell your colleagues, peers and what have you, because I think it's an important contribution to New Zealand society and particularly Palmerston North. So, once again, please thank Peter.